Next is New Jersey Transit Corporation versus Sanchez and Smith. If counsel could please step forward.
Perello, Malin, and Capuzzo on behalf of the defendant petitioners Sandra Sanchez and Chad Smith.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Ryan Gaffney, also Chasen Lamparello, Malin and Capuzzo, also on behalf of Sandra Sanchez and Chad Smith.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Sean Huber from Brown and Connor on behalf of the plaintiff respondent, New Jersey Transit.
Good afternoon, Richard Albuquerque, the Darcy Johnson Day firm on behalf of Amicus New Jersey Association.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Mellon.
Thank you, Your Honors. It may please the court. If I may, can I reserve a moment or two at the end for rebuttal? Thank you. As the court is well aware, this matter arises out of a workers' compensation carrier's right to subrogate, where the injured employee, who is subject to the verbal threshold, cannot establish a permanent injury and therefore is not pursuing a claim on his own. For more than 20 years, this type of claim was barred by the appellate division case of Continental versus McClelland. When this case made its way up to the appellate division after having been dismissed by Judge Polifroni at the trial level, the appellate division came to an opposite conclusion to the court to the Continental court and permitted the claim. Therefore, we have two conflicting appellate division decisions on a very similar issue. In permitting this claim, the appellate division also barred the application of the verbal threshold. As a result of the appellate division's decision, the pendulum has swung from 20 years of no claims being permitted under this type of situation to now a situation where this current decision would permit such a claim. We contend that that was an error. And even more greater error, we contend that the barring of the verbal threshold as a defense for the defendants in this case was also an error. The workers' compensation statute sets forth that the workers' compensation carrier in presenting the subrogation claim has no greater rights than the employee would have had if they brought their own claim. Obviously, there's much interplay in this case between the workers' compensation statute and the ACRA statute. The ACRA statute only permits a claim for uncompensated loss under Section 2K of that statute. The Continental decision, although decided under ACRA, relying upon very similar language in ACRA's predecessor, came to the conclusion that a workers' compensation carrier was prohibited from pursuing a subrogation claim under these circumstances. Judge Polifroni, relying upon the Continental decision and the language of ACRA, came to a similar conclusion in prohibiting this plaintiff's action in this case. Both the Continental decision and Judge Polifroni based their conclusion on the fact that the injured worker had suffered no uncompensated loss.
Does Continental only apply to non-economic loss, pain and suffering? Because the verbal threshold does not apply to PIP. If the subrogation sought is primarily lost wages, medical bills, in other words, economic loss, does Continental apply to that?
Continental does apply to that, and it's not just...
How does the verbal threshold prevent a claim for PIP and lost wages?
The import of the verbal threshold in this whole equation is the verbal threshold is what bars the injured worker from pursuing their own claim for pain and suffering.
If there are economic losses here, how would the verbal threshold prevent a claim for economic loss? Absent the PIP statute would prevent it, the collateral source rule, of course.
Sure.
But the verbal threshold itself would not, because that only applies to non-economic loss, pain, suffering, loss of enjoyment of life, disability, and impairment, as opposed to medical bills and lost wages.
And I think to answer that, we need to look at the entire ACRA statute to reach that conclusion. And when looking at the entire ACRA statute, we do look at the section 2K, which bars a claim for uncompensated expenses, which in this case, all of Mr. McCargliano's expenses were compensated, so he has no uncompensated loss there.
I interrupted you. Finished. I didn't look at my watch. I know you reserved time, so go back to your...
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Turning to the issue of the verbal threshold, the appellate division directed that the trial court enter plaintiff's motion for partial summary judgment, and that application was to remove the threshold as a bar to the claim submitted here. Now, the issue that
raises in particular, is that by barring the verbal threshold defense, that would permit the plaintiff to pursue a claim for partial permanent disability, which was a portion of the workers' compensation payments made here. In a total of approximately $33,000 in payments that were made here, approximately $22,000 of that was for partial permanent disability. Now, why is that important? The partial permanent disability portion of the award truly is non-economic loss. The partial permanency disability is based upon interference with the worker's life, other aspects of his life, not just his ability to work. It's akin to a pain and suffering award in a tort case. And for evidence of that, we only need to look at the actual facts of this case. There aren't many of them available to us, but what we do know is that this accident happened on December 2nd, 2014. By January 16, 2015, a mere 6 or 7 weeks later, the plaintiff was declared to be, Mr. Mercogliano was declared to be at maximum medical improvement and was cleared to return to work. The portion of the award, the total workers' compensation award, approximately $4,000 was paid to him for his lost wages. And then he received an award for this partial permanent disability of approximately $22,000. That obviously contemplates issues that he may have had in his life extending past that date of January 16, 2015 when he was returned to work. If plaintiff New Jersey Transit wishes to pursue that, the defendant should have the benefit of the verbal threshold as a defense, because if the plaintiff, as subrogee of Mercogliano, is unable to prove permanency, then that portion of the workers' compensation claim that was paid would be an issue and arguably not recoverable by plaintiff New Jersey Transit in this case. We submit that that was an error in this case. I think it's also important to look at ACRA, which has interplay in this, and the legislative intent of ACRA. The goal of ACRA is to reduce claims and therefore reduce the cost of automobile insurance. ACRA sets forth a limitation on the right to sue for non-serious injuries in exchange for prompt payment of medical expenses. Allowing this claim to go forward is going to open up a new avenue of claims that, as I said in the beginning, have been barred for more than 20 years. That's going to, and I know plaintiff is making the argument that there'll actually be less litigation, but the point is there will be more claims, and plaintiff has conceded that in their brief. Although they think that the claims maybe will resolve quicker, I don't know that there's a guarantee of that. There may, in fact, be much more litigation. But even if we were to assume that there wasn't going to be more litigation, there would be more claims, and it's going to work against the goals of ACRA, which is to reduce automobile insurance by reducing those claims. Plaintiff also concedes that those rates can be adjusted if there are, in fact, more claims. Well, we all know that those rates are not going to be adjusted downward. Automobile insurance rates would be adjusted up if there are more claims being paid by the automobile carriers to compensate these workers' compensation subrogation claims. Therefore, the goals of ACRA are not going to be met by allowing the appellate division's decision to stand in this matter.
Let me ask you something about the trial court's decision, and tell me if I'm misunderstanding the court's decision. The judge notes that the statute, Section 40F, limits the workers' compensation carrier, in this case NJT's, subrogation rights to statutory language as such right of action that the injured employee would have had against the defendant. Obviously, that's what the statute says. And then goes on to say that there was no action for economic loss, because in order to have subrogation, it has to be an uncompensated loss, and then says this was not an uncompensated loss because New Jersey Transit paid the plaintiff. So what the court is essentially saying is you can never have a subrogation action against a party can never bring a subrogation action for damages that party itself paid. And that does not seem equitable to me.
But I think it's under the limited circumstances where you have an injured worker who is subject to the threshold. Once we get away from that, and then once you get away from an automobile loss, then the whole thing wouldn't apply.
I understand that. I understand it's limited to automobile losses just by its nature.
Right.
And because of the ACRA aspect to it. But the fact is that the statute talks about uncompensated losses in order to not have a double windfall for the plaintiff. And in this case, the compensation to the plaintiff was from New Jersey Transit, and I'm talking about Mr. Mercogliano. And the court is saying, well, too bad, you, the subrogee, cannot sue for that amount because it turns out the driver was compensated, but it's the subrogee who did the compensation. Did you ever see what I mean?
Right.
And there's a lack of equity in that result, is there not? Like, you paid him, tough luck. He turned out to be paid, so you can't subrogate.
And I think there's a few things behind that. What, you know, one is that as the Continental Court points out, even though the injured worker may not have recovered PIP, they are still in the system by virtue of them having purchased an automobile policy that provides PIP.
Right.
And although, let's take our case, Mercogliano only collected the workers' compensation, but there are instances
where he didn't meet the verbal threshold. But that's still holding against the plaintiff in this case the fact that they previously paid the comp benefits to the driver and saying you can't subrogate for that because he got paid even though they're the ones who paid him.
Right. And then I think we also have to look at ACRO, which is trying to reduce smaller claims from being brought and therefore reduce automobile insurance premiums. And then there probably is a balancing test, too, of who is better.
Isn't that fly in the face of this classic definition of subrogation? A carrier pays and they seek to obtain the money that they paid from someone else. In order to have a subrogation card, the carrier has to have paid someone, in this case, the victim.
Right.
So if you pay and you can't subrogate, there is no subrogation. That's the classic definition of subrogation. Carrier pays and seeks it from another party.
Right, and it's our contention that under these limited circumstances, there is no claim for subrogation under the facts of this case and similar cases to that. And it goes back to defining the subrogation claim. The subrogor always stands in the shoes of the subrogee.
Isn't the reason why there's no subrogation here, this is your argument, is the legislature made a policy choice. Out of whose pocket is this payment going to be made? Is it going to be made out of the automobile insurers or workers' comp? And that the legislature was concerned about tamping down the cost of rising insurance premiums. And that's the reason why it made the workers' comp the primarily responsible for these payments. Isn't that your argument?
Right, and that's what I was just getting to with the balancing test.
Parallel statute 39689.1, where if a workers' compensation carrier denies it, it provides coverage. The PIP carrier is called upon to pay the PIP bills immediately, and then once the determination is made in the workers' compensation court that it was compensable, the PIP carrier has a subrogation right against the workers' compensation carrier.
That is true.
That's 9.1. So doesn't that show what I was just talking about, that there seems to be an attempt by the legislature to tamp down the PIP cost?
Exactly.
So
the cases talk about that too. When it's between PIP and workers' comp, even if PIP has to pay, eventually the burden's going to shift to workers' comp.
So the insured here could have sought PIP benefits, right?
I'm sorry, I missed.
The insured here could have sought PIP benefits, and they would have been immediately paid for the economic loss, correct?
Correct.
Then the PIP carrier could have sought reimbursement from the workers' compensation carrier,
yes.
Correct?
Correct.
Now the question is, could the workers' compensation carrier under that circumstance go after the carrier of the tortfeasor?
And
your answer is?
Is no.
Right. So the question, and we know that the PIP carrier would not be able to go after the tortfeasor. That's clear, correct?
That's clear, correct.
So the question is, by happenstance of the insured not going originally to the PIP carrier, is a workers' comp carrier now going to be able to go after the tortfeasor?
And my response to that is, under these circumstances, they should not be, because of the goals of ACRA and trying to reduce those automobile premiums, and going to that balancing test, it seems to be the goal here to have these costs borne by the businesses that fund the workers' compensation premiums versus the driving public that's paying the automobile premiums based upon the goals of ACRA.
And don't you also have 39, 6, 8, 12? Because it's evidence of amounts collectible or paid under PIP cannot be admitted into evidence. So collectible, even though the insured went to workers' comp, they theoretically were collectible under PIP, right?
I would agree, and there are, although not in this case, there are instances where certain things may not be covered by workers' comp, and PIP may still have a role in a particular case.
But so there was no effort on the part of, tell me if I'm correct about this, on the part of New Jersey Transit to admit in the summary judgment proceeding evidence of what PIP could have paid.
There was no.
So that statute really is not relevant to this proceeding.
In this particular case, that was not part of the summary judgment evidence.
Would you agree? And you're making some policy. You're making some policy arguments. But would you agree that the exact scenario that we have in this case, when there is not a situation where the comp carrier is going after a PIP carrier, because PIP carrier is not in the mix, this exact scenario is not spelled out in the statutes?
Not spelled out. I would agree it's not spelled out, but by comparing the statutes and the case law, I think we can come to a conclusion that this is the correct result.
Right, but if this were a situation where there was a comp carrier versus a PIP carrier, there'd be no question. It would be legislatures made a clear determination of what that is.
Right, and but there's nothing as clear
as clear as that. So you're asking us to basically look at legislative intent in the statutes.
Did I hear you say that because Mr. Marcogliano had the verbal threshold that these benefits for medical expenses and lost wages cannot be recovered in a subrogation claim?
In a subrogation claim. Different from if Mr. Marcogliano could breach the threshold and was bringing his own claim, then Lambert applies and we have an entirely different situation.
So in that case, he breaches the threshold. That insurance company can now subrogate for non-economic loss and economic loss?
Well, if he breaches the threshold, presumably then he's bringing a claim and has put forth some proof to show that he breached
and
the threshold.
What I'm asking.
And in that instance, then the injured worker is bringing his own claim, and under the statute, only the injured worker can then pursue the reimbursement of the workers' compensation payment.
There'd be a lien.
And then they would have a lien on their recovery.
Does that lien include economic loss?
Yes. The medical and the wages.
Does that mean that when, let's say it goes to trial, breached the verbal threshold, got lots of medical expenses, comp carriers paid all of it, and does that now, because it's recoverable and it can be asserted against the recovery, go on the blackboard so the jury can consider it?
That's my understanding, is that those are, the medical, the comp lien itself doesn't go on. You don't come in and say, we have a comp lien.
Economic loss
now
goes on the blackboard.
Correct.
In that case, even though it's an auto accident, and even though essentially the requirements of PIP and the reimbursement for medical expenses and lost wages has been paid, albeit by another carrier.
Right, the medical and the lost wages, not permanency awards, but those, as you referred to, as economic, medical and lost wages. Yes, evidence can be submitted to them. They can be on the board at that point, and the major difference there is that you have what the cases refer to as the conjoined recovery, and when you look at Lefkin and Lambert and even the statute itself, they all talk about if there has been recovery, that's the language that's used throughout those opinions and in the statute, is if there has been a recovery by the injured worker, then the comp carrier has a lien against that recovery. And you know, that was issues dealt with in Lambert, that we're not challenging that decision in this here. We're really focused on this limited area where typically minor claims, someone had a minor work injury, they're not pursuing a claim for permanency, presumably because they don't have a permanent injury, they had some treatment, they may have missed some work, there were some payments made, and it is our position that under the Continental decision and looking, comparing the goals of ACRA and then workers' comp, that claim is barred.
How does the logic of Lambert apply, if at all, in your view?
In this case or in the...
In this case.
I think the where Lambert is instructive is when it refers to that recovery that's been made, because in Lambert and the other cases that were considered by the appellate division in that case, there had been workers' compensation payments made, but there also had been substantial recoveries in each of those matters. And as Judge Polifoni concluded in his opinion, presumably showing that person had either didn't have a threshold or had vaulted the threshold in order to be able to get to the point where they had recovered that amount of money. And I believe it was all by settlement. I don't recall those being trial verdicts. I think those were settlements. And then the issue in the Lambert decisions was whether or not the plaintiffs had to repay the medical portion of their workers' compensation lien back, and the court concluded that they did there. So that is a different scenario there, because you have an injured worker who has presumably had much greater injury and has been able to vault the threshold.
Isn't that a problem? Because in that case, if you are collecting for your pain and suffering by way of settlement, and the comp carrier is now subrogating as a lien and takes lost wages, economic loss and non-economic loss, instead of getting a double recovery for the plaintiff, they've essentially gotten a half a recovery. Because they're paying back the stuff that PIP would not have been entitled to get, and they're pulling it out of what they settled for in pain and suffering.
I would disagree that there's been half a recovery, and the reason why is the plaintiff has certain economic damages that they would submit in as part of that, and that would include the medical and the lost wages. And
as part of the settlement?
As part of their claims for damages. What they negotiate as a settlement obviously is going to differ in every case, but those are the claim for damages. And to the extent that there's a partial permanency disability award like we have here, and that has to be paid back, then that plaintiff has already received some compensation for that interference with his life. So there's no double recovery, but there's no half recovery either.
I get all that, but I thought in Lambert they specifically discussed it. I thought. I may be mixing up cases, or I may just misremember. I thought they discussed the fact that the recovery in the settlement was for pain and suffering, not economic loss.
My understanding was that whatever those recovery amounts were by the three plaintiffs in Lambert is it encompassed all of their damages, their pain and suffering, and their claims for economic damages. And that's typically the way that would be presented in a case where there was a workers' compensation lien by the injured worker who is now bringing his own bodily injury lawsuit, is they would have not only evidence of what pain and suffering they've had, but also their medical expenses and their lost wages. Okay. And typically when presented, the comp carriers don't always pay dollar for dollar on the wages, so as presented to a jury or in the claim, the number for lost wages is oftentimes larger than the payment that would have to be sent back to the comp carrier in those. Perhaps you get, if you're making $800 a week, they pay you $500 a week, but your claim is going to be for $800 a week as presented in the claim. Whether you recover that entire amount, again, is case-by-case basis.
Where in the mix, or to what extent, should we consider the policy that the legislature expressed in favor of subrogation for the reasons of essentially having the comp carriers get some of the money back?
Right, and obviously that is in the comp statute, the allowance of subrogation, but then we have ACRA, who, you know, in 1998 limiting that, and that is 2 years after the Continental decision came out, So Continental had clearly limited that type of claim. The legislature then convenes and passes the ACRA statute, presumably knowing about the Continental decision, and doesn't do anything to say, well, that was wrong. That's not what we meant. So the argument is that for all the reasons that I've said earlier, that the claim should be barred, that it should be barred, that in that instance, ACRA would trump the comm statute.
When the verbal threshold is not met and PIP does not come into play, do we have any expression of priorities by the legislature as to which policy should prevail over the other? Policy in favor of subrogation versus the policies expressed in ACRA in a case like this where there's no PIP recovery?
Right. If we're looking for express language, I would say we do not have express language, but we have the goals that were set forth by the legislature in ACRA in reducing the premiums, coupled with the case law that has interpreted, Continental interpreting ACRA's predecessor, and ACRA certainly didn't lessen up on the goals of, it strengthened the goals of cost savings, but then also the decisions that came after ACRA was passed, I think it was Patterson, and then there was an unreported appellate decision.
We do know the statute is clear. A PIP carrier can seek recovery from workers' comp. Workers' comp cannot seek recovery from PIP. And right. We also know that 1540 says that the right of action, subrogation, shall be only for such right of action that the injured employer or his dependents would have had against a third person, and had PIP paid out directly to the insured would not have been able to sue the tortfeasor. So the question is whether or not this circuitous subrogation right is going to be recognized by this court.
Right, and Judge Polifoni addressed that in that very instance, in the example you just gave, Justice, where you would have a situation where the PIP may pay, they go to comp, and then comp turns around and comes back to auto to try to get their money back, and not accepting that as the correct
right.
answer.
But that's not going to happen in this scenario, right? Because the PIP didn't pay.
PIP was not.
It was not going
right.
to pay.
In this particular case, no. PIP
yeah,
did not
in this
pay.
Particular case.
Right.
Anything you'd like to add?
The only other thing for now is that the argument has been made that by New Jersey Transit that Lambert overturned Continental, and I just like to point out that Lambert did not even discuss Continental in that decision, and I think Judge Polifoni addressed that very well in his decision that he prepared in this, that the two can coexist. Lambert, as I had mentioned earlier, deals with those instances where the plaintiff, or the injured worker, sorry, I'm confusing plaintiff and injured worker, where the injured worker can overcome the threshold and has collected, and where Continental is dealing with these workers' compensation subrogation actions. So they, as I said, Lambert doesn't even address Continental. It doesn't explicitly overturn it, and I don't even think it overturns it in practice. The two can coexist. They're not inconsistent with each other.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Mr. Huber.
May it please the court, counsel, the time has come for this court to finish what the appellate division started in 1988 with Lefkin. The appellate division again said twice in 2016 with Talmadge and with Lambert, and then most recently what the appellate division did here in 2018 with our case. And that is to finally state that the Workers' Compensation Act trumps ACRA when it comes to holding tortfeasors responsible for reimbursing employers and comp carriers for the benefits that a workers' compensation carrier or employer pays to an injured employee. And it doesn't matter whether that claim is brought by the individual employee in the form of a lien, like we had in Lefkin, Talmadge, and Lambert, or whether, like this case, when the employer or a workers' compensation carrier brings the claim by way of subrogation. And why is that? Well, because the legislature wants employers and workers' compensation carriers to be reimbursed by tortfeasors. the people who caused all these expenditures for having to be made. And because that's the idea, we should enforce it, Your Honors, should enforce it here as well. Now, when I think of the workers' compensation lien in particular, it's what I call a super lien. No matter how that lien has been attacked by employees who have brought their own claims, let's say, that lien has always been enforced. There's only one exception to that, and that comes up in the per quad context. But every other time, whether the injured employee is fully compensated or not, it didn't matter. That lien's got to be repaid. Remember, by the tortfeasor. And since these benefits are in the form of medical bills and lost wages, they are economic losses. They are not non-economic losses. Therefore, as the appellate division below said, the verbal threshold defense is not a bar to these claims. The verbal threshold defense applies. Why? Well, if I were to try this matter and the employee took the stand and testified about all these problems that he may have had, the jury would arguably be entitled to award him something for his pain and suffering. The defendants would be entitled to raise that verbal threshold defense in that context. So it was not inapplicable completely. It was simply not a bar to the claims that my client seeks because those are for economic losses. So, again, also as the appellate division said here, cases subsequent to Continental have not followed its reasoning as it relates to published appellate division opinions. And that started, they followed Lefkin, right? It started with Talmadge in 2016, and then, of course, Lambert, and then most recently what the appellate division did here. So it's time to overrule Continental. So I am here to ask that the appellate division opinion be affirmed and that there be a clear rule of law that the verbal threshold defense is not a bar to workers' compensation subrogation matters such as this. That concludes my opening statement.
Is it, when you say such as this, are we talking about only economic loss?
Yes, because that's what we're seeking here. It's in the form of medical bills and lost wages.
So when you say in cases such as this, you're talking about purely economic loss cases.
Correct, and therefore the verbal threshold is not a bar to the claims that my client seeks in this case because of economic losses.
The question I asked of your adversary, so I want to go through it and see the result that you think should be achieved.
Of course, Justice.
The plaintiff insured suffers an injury at the hand of a tortfeasor.
Yes.
And seeks compensation from his PIP carrier.
Yes.
Under that circumstance, you would agree that the economic recovery from the PIP carrier is not a basis for the plaintiff to sue the tortfeasor or the tortfeasor's insurance company, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So now the PIP carrier pays. Now the PIP carrier sues the workers' comp carrier for reimbursement, which the statute permits, correct?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Okay. So now the workers' comp pays, and now your argument is that the workers' comp carrier can now go after the tortfeasor's insurance company?
Absolutely, Judge, which is the same, Justice, which is the same thing Lambert said, by allowing an injured employee to sue a tortfeasor for paid medical bills. And remember, those are paid bills.
But so it looks to me, and I'm trying to think of the policy reason why the legislature is doing what it's doing. It's making a determination what insurance carriers should be carrying it, because someone's going to be paying increased premiums. If it's falling on the automobile side, it's going to be increased premiums to people who are purchasing automobile insurance. If it goes on the workers' comp side, it's going to be factored into an increase in goods. One way or the other, the money is going to be pushed off to the citizenry. The question is where, and it seems to me, but when it made the decision to allow the PIP carrier to seek recovery from workers' comp, it was making a policy decision. We're trying to keep the insurance premiums down. And your argument would seem to circumnavigate that particular
result.
Justice, ahead. The best answer I can give you to that is initially we're talking about holding a tortfeasor responsible, not a PIP carrier, first off.
But let's assume that these people have insurance carriers that are going to be paying it off. So
understood.
Let's start with that assumption.
But it's a liability carrier. So right. The liability carrier, when it sold that policy to the defendants in this case, already factored in the fact that they might be liable for something here. So I don't think there's going to be an increase in premiums. They've already factored that in.
You could say the same thing for PIP carrier. I mean, the same insurance company that is selling the PIP policy is selling the liability policy. So whether it's coming out of the liability policy or the PIP policy, that would result in an increase in premiums. Am I mistaken?
Well, I believe you are, Justice, and here's why. Because when an insurance carrier chooses to sell liability insurance, they are recognizing the fact that they may have to pay that claim out, right? So therefore, they factor that analysis into their analysis, the fact that a liability carrier may have to pay. It would be different if I was trying to say that a PIP carrier should now be responsible to have to pay.
Why do you think the legislature decided to permit the PIP carrier to seek a recovery from workers' comp?
Because, unfortunately, PIP carriers don't always pay when they should. And therefore, a fight broke out between a PIP carrier and a workers' compensation carrier over who should pay. And who suffered in that instance? The injured employee. So what the legislature said is, look, we're not going to put up with this. What we're going to do is, what we recognize you guys may have a fight. Number one, we want ultimately the workers' compensation carrier to be responsible. But because we recognize that a workers' compensation proceeding may take years or months to resolve, all the while, we don't want that injured employee to suffer, so therefore, we're going to say, you, Mr. PIP carrier, you're going to pay these benefits for now, but if it turns out that the workers' compensation carrier should have paid, we're going to allow you to be reimbursed. And that's the idea. We want people, the legislature wants people, when they're injured, to make sure that on the job, to make sure that they're compensated.
So you don't see that provision as an expression of the legislature's intent that when we are forced to a choice between comp carriers and PIP carriers, the latter prevails. You're seeing that as a very narrow circumstance where PIP benefits are paid.
Yes, because of that dispute, because we don't want the injured employee to be stuck in limbo. So therefore, we're going to make somebody pay. But ultimately, the ultimate source may be down the road, the workers' compensation carrier. But then we take it one step further and say, when you look at that between a workers' compensation carrier and a tortfeasor, who should pay? It's the tortfeasor should pay.
But if there's no intent, because we're not talking tortfeasor now, we're talking the initial subrogation, why not just let the PIP carrier pay since they're used to it? The fact that the legislature indicated PIP carrier shouldn't bear it, doesn't that show some kind of intent that the workers' comp carrier should bear these expenses?
Well, yes, but also, if ultimately those expenses that the workers' compensation carrier had to pay are the result of the actions of a tortfeasor, we have right in the legislature said, we're going to allow you to get your money back, Mr. Workers' Compensation Carrier, which is what I'm doing here.
You heard the questions earlier. Am I correct that in limiting subrogation because of the fact that it was compensated, the trial court has in essence said that to the injured employee in this case, you got paid by them and therefore they don't get paid?
I totally agree with that, Justice, and quite frankly, I had not thought of that argument until Your Honor mentioned it, and that's why you're up there and I'm down here. But in addition to that, Justice, it was the mere fact of if that employee had received $1 from a tortfeasor, that immediately would have to go back to me as the workers' compensation carrier. Hence, to me, that makes it uncompensated as well. So I looked at it from that viewpoint, and I think if you read the ACRA, the definition of uncompensated, what really the legislation was talking about there was outstanding. Outstanding is really what that means. But in this context, if that employee received $1, it would come right back to me as the comp carrier.
Let me just see if I understand your response. You're saying you obviously have the subrogation right if they got paid. Settled.
Or lien, I would say. Yes, Justice.
So you have the right to get that back.
Yes.
If uncompensated is taken so literally as to mean any time the person didn't get a bill paid, then that wouldn't happen either.
I would never have a claim. There would never be an instance for me to subrogate.
So what does uncompensated mean in that?
And what uncompensated means is it's viewed in the context of if that employee received $1 from a tortfeasor, he or she would have to immediately reimburse the workers' compensation carrier. That's what makes it uncompensated. Now, in practicality, would an employee
ever do that and work for me and try to get my clients lien reimbursed? Probably not. But that doesn't matter. It's what the legislature says in the statute and what the appellate division has said most recently, of course, here, but of course just prior to that in Lambert, allowing an injured employee to flat out pursue a tortfeasor in a car crash case for paid medical bills. Those medical bills were paid. They were not uncompensated, and Lambert clearly allows. Why is that? We want to hold that tortfeasor
responsible. So that tells us what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean the paid medical bills. You're saying it doesn't mean a situation such as this where there is a subrogation, right? What category did the legislature intend to mean with that word uncompensated?
I think they meant to use the word outstanding.
Just outstanding but, and
correct.
Unpaid
but
by anybody?
Correct. And remember, that comes up in the context of, you know, in two places, right? We have it in the ACRA statute, and then we have it again in the Workers' Compensation Act, the use of that phrase. But when I think if you look at it from the ACRA's viewpoint, it really meant outstanding is really the better word. And here, if we look at it from an uncompensated viewpoint, what makes it uncompensated is if that employee got a dollar, he could not keep it. And therefore, it's uncompensated. Yes, his medical bills were paid, but the medical bills were paid in Lambert as well. And as Your Honor has already pointed out, there would never be a situation where I could subrogate because I'm the one who paid the bills. That's why I'm trying to subrogate. So they've been paid. They're not outstanding anymore.
Section 40 yes. says that the rights that the workers' comp carrier has are no greater than its injured victim, right?
Agreed.
Okay. So now go back to the example I gave you. PIP carrier pays him off.
Okay. Yes.
He cannot sue directly, right?
He can. Because he's an injured employee and Lambert says he can. If I'm following you through, Justice.
No, so the PIP carrier pays its insured for his economic damages.
Yes.
Okay. The insured, under those circumstances, cannot sue the tortfeasor for economic damage.
If it ends right there, absolutely
right.
Correct.
So why does it change? Why does that sentence change when the PIP carrier gets reimbursed by the workers' comp carrier? Because under that circumstance, the insured from the beginning was not able to sue. Are you saying that sentence changes when the workers' comp carrier reimburses the PIP carrier?
No, Justice. And the real answer there is because the PIP carrier should have never paid any money in that instance. The workers' compensation carrier is primary.
That's contrary to what you just said earlier, because you said that under the structure around no fault,
right,
PIP should be paying immediately the expenses. Look, the injured victim should not have to go through a court proceeding, even workers' comp. That takes time. The whole purpose of this policy was to ensure the immediate payment of the medical bills.
Agreed.
By PIP, correct?
Correct.
That's what you said.
I did say that, Justice, but that's in the context of where there's a workers' compensation claim being brought as well. It's not a situation where it's PIP and there's no workers' compensation claim. There is a workers' compensation claim, but when there's a dispute in that instance. And typically what happens in all reality is the workers' compensation carrier pays. But if there's a dispute, standard PIP application, one of the questions is what? Is this a workers' compensation claim? Do you have workers' compensation insurance? And what the legislature doesn't want is what I said earlier, which is for a dispute to arise whether those benefits should be paid. Therefore, PIP steps in. But ultimately, you, Mr. Comp Carrier, you're the one who's responsible for paying these benefits.
Look, when it's just economic damages, it makes sense for the insurer just to go to its PIP carrier. It doesn't have to go to court. It makes a claim, and it gets its medical bills paid. Under that circumstance, the insured cannot sue the tortfeasor, but the PIP carrier will seek recovery from the workers' comp.
Yes.
And
that's because we want the workers' compensation carrier to be the primary payer.
Let me.
And there are additional benefits besides medical bills under PIP. I'm sorry, Justice. I'm sorry.
Let me pick up on something Justice Salvin was asking. I'm not sure this, well, I guess it could happen. You have a disputed comp claim.
Yes.
Course and scope, not course and scope. PIP carrier pays.
Yes.
No verbal threshold.
I'm sorry, Justice.
No verbal threshold. It's got the no threshold.
Got it.
Provision in the policy. Sues for pain, suffering against the third party.
Yes.
So far, PIP's paid. Comp claims disputed. K Can he board the medical expenses?
He cannot.
And wages? He cannot.
He cannot.
Can he what?
Even though, board them. Put them on the board of the
right.
trial.
Yeah. I understand what
you're saying. So when he recovers, and I think that's, was it Continental that said that or Lambert that said that? When he recovers and he gets not medical, not lost wages, and he's got that $250,000, I think it was in the case I'm referring to, the comp lien now, the comp carrier has now kicked in. They lost. They've now kicked in. They got a full lien against the 250?
Well, I think you just changed the facts a little bit there, Justice. I understood you to mean that there was no comp claim.
No. Disputed comp claim.
Disputed, right. So it hasn't been adjudicated.
Scope. Right.
Okay.
So PIP carrier pays lost wages, medical expenses.
Oh.
Trial goes forward.
Yes.
Does everything go on the board?
Well, I think in that instance, what would have to happen is the workers' compensation carrier should step in and intervene in the underlying third-party matter and ask for a stay to resolve it. Otherwise, you're going to try the case, and you may have to try it twice.
That's
because in Your Honor's instance, those would not be boardable because there's no workers' compensation lien at that point. So therefore, all of that evidence that you just suggested is completely inadmissible. But it may wind up coming back later on if it turns out.
So the answer is there's no answer to that question.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The answer is there's no answer to that question because I'm not aware anywhere that it says that's kind of the way it goes. I know that the comp carrier may move for a stay, and the trial judge is going to say, I won't tell you what he's going to say.
I'll say no.
Yeah, okay. That's the way. I was going to say something different.
But and maybe there's a jurisdictional argument there as well because, you know, workers' compensation matters cannot be heard by the Superior Court. But I have not encountered that scenario. But ultimately, if the stay was denied, then I guess there's a possibility of trying the case twice because then once the workers' compensation carrier did pay, they would, in essence, have a lien at that point, and therefore it should be boardable at that instance.
I thought, and obviously I'm confused because I don't remember which case had what, but in one of the cases, there was a settlement or a payment for pain and suffering, and the comp carrier effectively intervened and asserted a lien for permanency, which is pain and suffering, and lost wages and medical expenses.
Well, that is Lambert. That is Lambert. And
how is that right?
Well, from doing third-party work, one of the things that I often struggle with in plaintiff's cases, Your Honor, was since I have to repay, let's say, the permanency portion of the award, or even before Lambert, when I had to repay the medical expenses, before Lambert, I couldn't sue that tortfeasor to get those medical bills back, but I still have to pay that permanency award, and I often found it unfair that I was not able to, in essence, to use Your Honor's phrase, board the permanency award, even though I had to reimburse it. Now, if we look at Lambert, as it relates to the lost wages portion of the workers' compensation lien, medical bills and lost wages, the dispute was over medical bills. The lost wages portion of the lien, the plaintiffs in those consolidated cases, in each case agreed to repay the workers' compensation carrier for those lost wages. That wasn't even in dispute. It was just the medical bills only, which Lambert ultimately said you could pursue a tortfeasor in that instance. So just to conclude, I would ask again that the appellate division opinion be affirmed, and we have a nice, clear, bright-line rule that because these are economic losses, not non-economic losses, the verbal threshold defense is inapplicable. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Albuquerque.
May it please the court, thank you for allowing the New Jersey Association for Justice to participate in this oral argument. Our concern in wanting to get involved is that the procedural posture of this case, I think, is actually quite rare, where you have the work comp employer suing the tortfeasor to collect a portion of the lien. I think what is much more common and exists throughout all the courts of the state in significant numbers are claims by the actual employees. The employee is in a car crash, and the employee sues the tortfeasor, and he was hurt in the course of his employment. So he's collected workers' compensation benefits. So he now knows in the course of this third-party case, he's not only suing for pain and suffering, but he's suing for the medical bills that his employer has paid and the disability that his employer has paid because he has to reimburse those things back to his employer under Section 40 of the work comp statute. So the way the case is presented to the jury in a verbal threshold, which is what we're dealing with here, is the employee presents the elements of his medical bills, he presents the elements of his lost wage, and he tries to convince the jury that he has also suffered a permanent injury so that he can get a pain and suffering award. And there was a question posed by the justice as to whether the legislature would be opposed to sort of shifting the responsibility back to the liability insurer as opposed to the workers' compensation system? And I'd like to answer that question because I don't think they're opposed. Because if that employee can prove to the jury that he has suffered a permanent injury, then he is allowed to get the medical bills and the temporary disability.
So what does that have to do with the workers' comp carrier? That's an individual right of the insured to sue. What does that have to do with whether or not the PIP carrier or the workers' comp carrier is...
Because in that situation, PIP carrier is not involved. Only the workers' compensation carrier is involved. So it's not like the legislature is saying in a verbal threshold case, you can't sue for the medical bills and temporary disability that your employer has had. You're allowed to recover that from the tortfeasor, and if he has an insurance policy, the insurer has to indemnify their insured and pay that money, and then when I collect the money, I reimburse workers' comp.
Now, NJAJ is here telling us affirm with a twist the appellate division. And you're indicating that you're not here on behalf, as much as you may love lawyers for comp carriers, they are not the closest to your heart. You're here for plaintiffs who would be asserting their own claim.
Yes.
What I'm wondering about, and I may have misunderstood something, is why you are concerned with the trial court's decision in this case, since it was so heavily infused with statutory provisions on subrogation and concepts of subrogation. Stated simply, how could the trial court's decision hurt individual plaintiffs as opposed to comp carriers?
Because the rights of the employer and the employee are exactly the same under Section 40 of the workers' compensation lien and the rights of subrogation. So whatever you hold here as to the rights of the employer is going to be exactly what is going to apply to the rights of the employees who are really the ones bringing these claims throughout the state. So if you overturn the appellate division and say that an employer cannot collect medical benefits paid and temporary disability paid unless they satisfy the verbal threshold, which is really the crux of the question here. If you hold that and overturn the appellate division, that's going to apply to every employee action. If you affirm the appellate division, then me representing an individual employee suing a tortfeasor, not only am I in there fighting to collect my hopefully award for pain and suffering if I can prove a permanent injury, but I'm also in there fighting to get back the money that my employer paid.
But if the employer has no right, then he also has no right against your client, the employee. So how is your client hurt? He collects on the third-party action for whatever. Workers' comp carrier can't go against him or the tortfeasor, so your client loses nothing. It's a net.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct in terms of he's not pulling money out of his pocket.
Right.
But the employee has a duty to cooperate with the employer to help collect the benefits the employer has paid on his behalf.
Well, that duty means you show up and testify at a deposition. The insurers have a duty to help direct defense of their cases. Everyone, it's not a policy, you have a duty to, you know, help with the litigation, the defense.
But once the
but there's no money out of your, I'm sorry, there's no money out of your client's pocket if the workers' comp carrier can't collect it either.
That's true, Justice, but once the employee sues, he must go after the medical bills that his employer paid and the temporary disability that his employer paid, because once I file suit on behalf of the employer is barred by Section 40 to bring their own action. They're totally relying upon me to collect their lienable items.
But my point is that if there is no action allowed by the employer, if we rule that way, then your client does not need the help because there's nothing ever going to come from your client from the employer by way of lien.
Practically speaking, we're still going to bring the claims because the truth of the matter is we're only bringing these claims because we believe we can prove a permanent injury. We're not out there filing suits on behalf of employees just to collect the medical bills and the temporary disability that the employer paid, because in that situation, even if you win, there's no net benefit to your client. You're not going to put your client through a litigation where he's not going to get anything out of it.
I'm sorry. I want to follow up on Justice Fernandez-Vina's question. There is no bar, tell me if I'm mistaken, there's nothing barring the plaintiff from suing the tortfeasor and seeking workers' comp at the same time, is there? You have a third party, and he was injured at work, so he can seek both at the same time.
Okay.
So I'm just not seeing how Judge Polifrani's decision in any way adversely affects the insured, the plaintiff. The plaintiff can seek his full recovery from the tortfeasor, can get whatever he can from the workers' comp, provided there's no double recovery. You get fully remunerated. The only problem under Judge Polifrani's decision is for the workers' comp carrier. The workers' comp carrier cannot proceed after the liability carrier for the defendant. And I'm trying to see how you get hurt.
Because as a practical matter, in order for me to pursue the third party, I have to know how much I have to pay back to the employer.
Yeah, right. It reduces the lien.
I have to
that,
know what the
your
lien
interest
is.
In it, your client's, potential client's interest in it is that, and that's why you're supporting them, is because if they're allowed to bring the action that's brought here, that reduces the ultimate comp lien that your client faces in the action against the tortfeasor.
Yes, because we are the ones bringing these claims.
Right.
I know this case is the employer, but we're the ones bringing the claims. I believe a majority of the time is the employee is suing the tortfeasor, not the employer suing the tortfeasor, as in this case.
And there's a lien, going to be a lien on your recovery from the comp carrier. So you are aligned. Your interests are aligned with the comp carriers, because either way, they're going to get back from you if you settle the case.
Yes, and the comp carriers routinely cooperate with us because they want to get their money back. And for me to go after that tortfeasor, I have to know how much med, temp, and perm is going to be there, because I have to pay back 2/3 of that amount.
But why are you involved at all? I mean, it almost sounds like you're making their point. Why are you involved at all? If this is a verbal threshold case, and you as the plaintiff can't sue anybody for anything unless you bring a comp claim or a PIP claim, what right do you have? And if the comp carrier stands in your shoes, what right does the comp carrier have? So it sounds to me like you're making their point.
I hope I'm not making their point.
Okay, I know you're right. Go ahead.
Our interest is that whatever you decide here today as to the rights of the employer to collect these monies is going to be binding on all of the employees that we represent throughout the state.
This is a verbal threshold case.
Yes.
It affects only those cases where the employee can't sue. Right? So regardless of how we decide that issue, it's not going to affect you at all. And why should we I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do this.
Okay.
Why should we decide that issue in the insurance, in the workers' compensation insurance carrier's favor, if the employee can't sue?
Because if you affirm the appellate division decision in this case, and hold that an employer can sue a tortfeasor and collect medical bills and indemnity without having to satisfy the verbal threshold, then I can make that same argument on behalf of the employee in the same type of case. So the questions on medical bills and temporary
wouldn't that destroy the entire purpose of ACRA if you're allowed to suddenly, because you happen to be in the happenstance, you were in the scope of employment, you were driving your truck to make a delivery, now you throw out the verbal threshold, you throw out ACRA, and that's the end of it?
Well,
would that destroy it? And where is the harm to your client if we say the workers' comp carrier cannot proceed against the tortfeasor? Because if they can't, they have no lien against you either. They're not allowed to be compensated for those fees. So you don't lose any money one way or the other. Your client doesn't have to worry about, out of his pain and suffering award, paying money back to the comp carrier because it doesn't exist. So that consideration is not an issue any longer.
If you rule that ACRA is more important than the Workers' Comp Act, then you're correct. But as Lambert held, and as I think the court here held, when they stated that the issue is governed by the Workers' Comp Act and not ACRA, that's the point we're trying to make. The Workers' Comp Act should take priority over the subrogation rights of the employer and the employee. But for the negligence of the tortfeasor, nobody's here. Employer's not paying medical bills. Employer's not paying temp. So at the end of the day, why should we benefit the liability tortfeasor over the employer and the employee and the workers' comp carriers? These courts said we shouldn't. We agree with that. And we're here because your opinion is going to address these rights as to the employer, but they're going to have an effect on hundreds, if not thousands, of cases where the employee is involved.
Even if limited to economic loss, they and no issue on the verbal threshold.
That's correct.
That would still have that kind of impact.
Well, in a practical matter, I would say no, because if you hold that you have to pierce the verbal threshold to get these elements of the workers' compensation lien, then obviously the employers aren't going to bring these types of standalone cases, because the understanding is that the person can't meet the verbal.
What
the employees aren't going to bring them either.
What if the court's holding is limited, no matter how it comes out, to situations where the plaintiff has not met the verbal threshold, and the only issue in any event is economic loss, which would not implicate the verbal threshold.
Yes,
the question
and concern I would have is how can you give or delineate that the employer has that right and not give that same right to the employee, since they both derive from the same exact statute?
We have a verbal threshold case. Yes. Are you asking us to decide this case outside of the facts that we have before us?
No. We just want to, our concern is that if you hold that the employer does not have to satisfy the verbal threshold to collect medical bills and temporary disability, that the same exact thing would apply to an employee.
No, assume that they are stuck with the verbal threshold.
Yes.
Okay. Tell under those circumstances, are your clients going to be in a more difficult position as a result of Judge Polifrani's ruling? Assuming that they're barred, they cannot do what the insured could not do. The insured is barred by the third verbal threshold, and therefore the workers' comp is going to have a similar bar. Under those circumstances, is the class of plaintiffs who you're representing in any way going to be harmed or distressed by Judge Polifrani's decision?
No.
Oh, okay.
Anything else you'd like to present? Thank you. Mr. Mellon, you get the last word.
I have a few issues I'd like to address very briefly, if I may. There was a question asked about a factor in premiums, and the reality is, in terms of those premiums that are already being paid, for 22 years, workers' compensation carriers have not been able to subrogate for these types of claims that we're here on today. So that's already built in, whereas the auto carriers have not been paying those liens back. So that would result in a change in premiums, which obviously would affect the motoring public who's paying.
Stop right there. You're saying up until today, they have not been subrogating for economic losses?
Only in these very narrow, I'm not talking about Lambert. I'm talking about Mercogliano type cases, talking about Continental versus McClellan.
So basically, PIP's on their own and comp's on their own.
Right. There have not, since Continental came out in 1996, up until our case, the overwhelming custom, or that may be the wrong word,
practice.
Has been that, practice, thank you.
There you go.
Has been that these claims don't exist. And obviously, this plaintiff is attempting to change that, and with the appellate division decision in this case, has now created a different opinion.
So I may already be misremembering, but your position is when the workers' comp carrier pays PIP benefits, essentially medical economic loss that would normally be paid by PIP, that doesn't go on the board in the third-party claim, in a claim against the tortfeasor, or it does at the trial?
In the claim by the injured worker, who is arguing that they meet the threshold or maybe has
right.
no threshold.
At trial.
Yes, I believe that's what I said earlier, is they
Isn't
can
that
go on the
inconsistent
board.
With what you just said?
It's not, because there's a big difference between the case where the injured worker brings the claim and will offer evidence of their medical expenses and their lost wages versus what we have here, where the injured worker has made a determination that they don't even meet the threshold. Typically, these very minor accidents, minor injuries, there's not a lot to them, and they're not even pursuing a claim.
You know, this case has Mercogliano's name in it, but probably since January of 2015, he has had no involvement in this case at all. It really now falls on his employer, New Jersey Transit.
So you both agree, both sides agree, that the economic loss, where it's payable by the workers' comp carrier, goes on the blackboard in a claim against the tortfeasor.
Where the injured worker is bringing the claim.
Okay.
Yes.
But in the absence
of... And then the lien affects the lien.
But in the absence of vaulting the verbal threshold, they can't get that in that limited case, where the verbal threshold has not been vaulted. They can't do that. They can't get that medical that they could get in a nonverbal case.
When it's simply a workers' compensation carrier subrogating, yes, then that would be barred. And in terms of the impact on the injured worker, they don't have to pay anything back to a workers' comp carrier until they recover something. So there is no harm to the injured worker here. There's no threat to them that they're going to owe money back to their workers' comp carrier.
Well, they're not suing in this case anyway.
In this case, there's
no threat at all to Mr.
Mercogliano,
who probably doesn't know we're here today.
No.
And doesn't care because he is not going to sue. He is not worried about a lien, and he's not going to get hit with any kind
exactly.
of charge from his comp carrier.
I won't let you get through your 2 minutes, so let's see if we can do that.
Okay, thank you. The other issue, two other issues I just wanted to bring up. Mr. Huber made the comment that the Workers' Comp Act wants reimbursement by the tortfeasors, and I would disagree with that. The emphasis of the Workers' Compensation Act is to reimburse injured workers. They do allow subrogation, but the emphasis is not on reimbursement. If anything, in terms of the subrogation, it's on balancing the parties. What the Workers' Compensation Act goal is to prevent that double recovery, so that if the injured worker collects his comp benefits and then pursues a third-party claim and collects money from the tortfeasor, they don't have a double recovery. They have to reimburse the comp carrier, for the monies that were paid out. So I disagree that is the goal and emphasis of the workers' compensation statute. In terms of the plaintiff's claims, I disagree that they're all economic. As I argued earlier, those claims for partial permanent disability are certainly non-economic in nature, and therefore it is, I think, very important for defendants in these type of cases that they are able to raise the verbal threshold as a defense to those where the comp carrier is bringing a claim for those partial permanent disability awards. And then finally, as to the NJAJ's position, I agree that Judge Polifroni's decision does not impact individual plaintiffs who might be interested in bringing the lawsuit. As we just noted, Mr. Mercogliano in this case probably has no idea that we're here. He has no interest in this. And typically, these types of cases that we're here about are those subrogation cases. We're not talking about having an injured worker who has any interest in that. It's limited to workers' comp and subro actions.
And let me just understand that point. And is that because, having not met the verbal threshold, he's not going to sue anybody?
Right.
And he's not going to be subject to a lien, so the size of a potential lien is not of any concern.
Exactly. Right. They at that point, they have no skin in the game. It does end up with their name on it, but outside of that, they really have no involvement unless maybe they'd be called to testify about what happened to them if there was ever a trial on that. But again, they have no interest in the outcome. And as to the NJAJ's interest in this, I don't know why an injured worker would ever sue solely to get their comp carrier's money back. You know, typically the injured worker will sue because they're interested in gaining pain and suffering compensation for themselves, but I can't imagine that there'd be a situation where an injured worker would say, you know, out of the goodness of my heart, I'm going to try to get my employer or their workers' comp carrier's money back. And if that's something that is going to be encouraged, then we're certainly going against the goals of ACRA, because now we are going to have additional litigation in our courts, and that's what we're trying to, that's what ACRA is trying to avoid. So those are the issues I wanted to address. Thank you. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you to counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement. We're going to take a brief recess and then return.